Arizona water officials often point to the state's planning in comparisons with our neighbors to the west. But how can Arizona keep its water glass full?
The critical question of the day actually is whether we now have both the economic strength and the political will to execute these recommendations that came out of town hall.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the relationship between good schools and affordable homes. We hear from two more Phoenix neighborhoods on what residents would like to see in the city's new police chief.
The effort to simplify medical information.
And trying to eliminate a derogatory term that started with better intentions.
The idea is that as opposed to some sort of terminology that points to race or that had been associated with race, this has an air of neutrality.
Plus supermarket swaps, and we hit for the cycle.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay sunny for the rest of this afternoon, expecting a high temperature around 76. Should be clear tonight with lows in the lower 50s. Sunny skies tomorrow warming to 79. It's currently 69 degrees at KJZZ.
The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a bill blocking Syrian and Iraqi refugees from entering the country unless they pass strict background checks. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke has more from today's vote.
Earlier this year, President Obama announced the U.S. would admit 10,000 Syrian refugees. Now the House has approved a bill limiting the number of refugees admitted, but only until increased security is in place. Democrat Ruben Gallego of Phoenix says representatives may be taking action too quickly.
We shouldn't be reacting to terrorism in this manner. If you want to do this, let's have a serious adult discussion of it. But knee-jerk moves are not the way to do it.
Republican Martha McSally of Tucson is a member of a task force looking into ISIS. She says their threat will remain even if the process changes.
There are gaps in that process, but that is not the sole solution to addressing the 32 findings that our task force identified related to the challenge of ISIS.
Discussions in the Senate are taking place. If a bill is approved there, it will go to the president's desk. He has previously threatened to veto the bill. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
How should Arizona plan for its water future? That was among the questions discussed at this week's Arizona Town Hall in Mesa. Joining me to talk about the recommendations that came out of the event are attendees Richard Morrison, a water attorney and board chair of ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy, and Catherine Sorensen, director of Phoenix's Water Services Department. Richard, to you, what was the biggest recommendation from the discussion?
Well, certainly one of the strongest recommendations is that we adequately fund the Arizona Department of Water Resources so that it can restore lost staffing needed to complete the Arizona General Stream Adjudication. The General Stream Adjudication is a very complicated judicial proceeding designed to prioritize everybody's water rights on the major river systems in Arizona.
Catherine, what about you? What are some of the big top one or two things that came out of this?
Well, one of the things I saw was that there was a very broad consensus to move forward with Arizona's strategic vision for water supply sustainability. The Department of Water Resources spent a lot of time over the last couple of years developing this document, visiting every single watershed across the state, doing analysis of, you know, supplies versus demands and different management techniques. And so people, I think, understood that that's a document from which we can start a lot of really great conversations.
In reading through the draft recommendations, it seems like there are a lot of them that involve money in some way or another, either the state spending money or consumers potentially, water users potentially spending more money. I want to talk about the public money first, the state money. Is there enough money? Is there the will to do some of the stuff or any of the things that this document recommends?
Well, in recent years, obviously, the budgetary challenges faced by the legislature have prevented adequate funding of the Department of Water Resources and other water-related funds that are already statutorily authorized. So it's been a big problem. And the critical question of the day actually is whether we now have both the economic strength and the political will to execute these recommendations that came out of town hall.
Do you think we do?
Well, here's what I think. The people have spoken. The people at town hall spoke with one voice in support of greater funding for DWR and for more infrastructure and for more conservation technology. It's what Arizonans have said they want. And now what we have to look for is the leadership in the legislature to help make it possible.
Catherine, as head of Phoenix's water department, you deal with this on a daily basis, and you're currently in the process of trying to get a rate increase for your users. Do you think that people recognize sort of the value of the water they're using versus how much they're paying for it?
So, yeah, I do. Arizonans care deeply about water. I mean, that's clear. And Arizonans have very strong opinions about how water should be managed in their particular communities. There was a lot of talk about financing and funding of infrastructure, and that's really where the rubber hits the road, right? Especially in rural Arizona. In urban Arizona, we have the population base to use water rates successfully to pay for large infrastructure projects. But in rural Arizona, it's a different situation. Infrastructure is extremely expensive. When you start talking about the pipes, the pumps, the wells, the water treatment plants, the wastewater treatment plants, all the things that are necessary to manage water well, it's really expensive stuff. And it's one thing when you have a broad population to spread those costs over. It's another where you have a very limited population base. So we spent a lot of time over the last 3 days talking about those differences and how to make up the gaps in funding.
Richard, what is the state of Arizona's water infrastructure statewide?
Well, in most areas, the water infrastructure is still working quite well. But, you know, one of the things panelists discussed this week is that deferred maintenance is a problem almost all over the United States in various contexts. And some of our systems are aging. What most Arizonans probably don't know is that historically, most water has been delivered at a price that's almost free if you consider the question of whether anything is being paid for water molecules. Almost all of the price is attributable to the cost of developing the water, storing it, transporting it, and treating it for delivery.
How do you try to balance the message to your customers that we're not going to run out of water tomorrow, like you're not going to turn on your tap and have sand come out, but at the same time, we need to start conserving it? I mean, it seems like kind of a contradictory message that you're trying to get out to people.
It's a very nuanced message is what I would say. And that's why what you see out of the city of Phoenix is you see that we focus on long-term efforts to change the culture of how we live here in the desert. So we really focus on making sure that people understand they need to embrace a desert lifestyle. And you do not see knee-jerk reactions to drought or other current situations. That's because we don't want people to react to their current environment. We want people to understand that it will always be hot and dry here, and that someday the drought will end, but it'll still be hot and dry. And so we need people to really understand that this is about embracing culture change over the long term.
Are both of you optimistic that some or all of the recommendations that came out of this Arizona town hall will in fact be implemented?
I'm always optimistic. And you know, Richard made a good point. The people have spoken, I think, with a very strong voice. There was broad consensus, and I think you would find that broad consensus across Arizona outside of the town hall process. Arizonans care about water.
Well, I am too, for a couple of reasons. Most of these ideas are not new. They've been around for a while, so they're not shocking. We come back to the question I asked before, do we now have the political will to implement them, to carry through, to close the loop, accomplish the goal? And as we move ahead and as more water consciousness has been generated because of the California crisis, I think Arizonans understand the time is now.
Richard Morrison is a water attorney and board chair of the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. We also heard from Catherine Sorensen, director of Phoenix's Water Services Department. Both were among the participants of this week's Arizona Town Hall, keeping Arizona's water glass full.
The city of Phoenix is in the early stages of choosing the next police chief, and it's asked members of the broader community to chime in. On Tuesday's edition of the show, Mark talked with a resident of the Arcadia area and another from South Mountain. Now we'll hear from two other Phoenicians. First is Joe Mora, board member of United Neighbors Association, which is situated near 43rd Avenue between Glendale and Northern Avenues. Joe, how do you think Phoenix Police is doing currently in your area?
I think they're doing a good job. We just don't have enough officers. Our community Action Officer Garrick Henry. He does a really good job, but he has to be on the beat, and we would love to see more of him.
How important is the concept of community policing, knowing that the folks who patrol the neighborhood, your community officer, whatever it may be, that they really, that they actually recognize who lives there and know people on that personal basis?
So we actively participate in crime prevention in our community, and we want a police chief that's hired from within the community, that's already familiar with our programs, our community, and already has the trust and respect of police officers. We think that's important. We would love to. We need somebody who's continue to have good communication with the communities, and we're really interested as a community activist to expand on a lot of our community programs. So we need someone who has an openness and a willingness to work more with communities.
Chief Garcia came in. One of the appealing things that some people thought was that here was someone, a fresh voice, a fresh face from someone who is not from Phoenix. But do you have a thought on that, whether if the right candidate should be from in Phoenix, outside of Phoenix? Do you think it's important for someone to be really familiar with this specific area?
Very important. We need to know who we're getting, number one. We need to, they need to have some longevity here with the Phoenix Police Department so that everyone knows what we're getting. Everyone knows their style of leadership. Everyone knows what their visions are, have an understanding of how they manage. And we community leadership, we feel that's very important. And we don't want a leader to start from scratch and have to learn the streets and learn who we are and what we do. We don't really want an outsider. We want an established leader.
Joe Mora of the United Neighbors Association near 43rd Avenue between Glendale and Northern Avenues. Another perspective comes from Rick Robinson of the Tremonto Residents Alliance in the northwest part of Phoenix. Rick, how do you think Phoenix Police is doing the job in your part of the city?
Well, considering, you know, the problems that we have are few and far between because we're so far north, anytime we do have any issue, I've never seen any problems with what they, you know, the service they've provided.
There are some people who talk about, well, downtown Phoenix gets more priority or East Phoenix gets more priority. How important is that to you, this idea that every part of the city is thought of equally?
I think that's very important, particularly considering, you know, the fact that we're so far north, I don't want to say the response, but the number of officers that are associated with issues up in our part of the city is very limited. And that in turn can delay response because most of the officers that service our part of town have to drive from down in like Deer Valley or Happy Valley or across from Paradise Valley, Scottsdale areas. We don't have a whole lot of PD presence up in our part of town.
One of the things that comes up a lot with policing is this idea of community policing, that officers, regardless of what part of the city they're in, really get to know the people who live there. Is that something that you'd like to see prioritized with another chief? You'd like to have someone who sort of knows more about what's going on in each neighborhood, if possible?
I would have to say, as a neighborhood association leader, yes.
Rick Robinson of the Tremonto Residents Alliance in the northwest part of Phoenix. The community survey on Phoenix's next police chief is open until November 30th.
Still to come, a rural West Valley school district, which saw its budget override go down for the fourth straight year, is concerned about the impact on things like school bus safety.
This year we did cut back on a few of our routes that were on dirt roads that were very rough. You know, there's a lot of wear and tear to the axles. We're just concerned about the safety of it.
Funding problems for the Nottaburg district is ahead on the show.
Good afternoon. It's 218 at KJZZ and checking Valley traffic. Accidents on I-10 westbound, couple of them, one at 51st Avenue, the other at 75th Avenue. 101 southbound near Broadway, the roadway has been reduced to one lane. That's in the East Valley. For tonight, we expect clear skies, overnight lows in the lower 50s. We continue our steady warming climb. Look for high temperature in the upper 70s tomorrow under sunny skies. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%, clear skies, and 73 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Carl's Quality Bakery, a family-owned Swiss pastry shop, seasonal pies, specialty dinner rolls, and more for over 20 years. Carl's Quality Bakery is open Monday through Saturday on the southeast corner of Central and Dunlap.
House hunters often ask about the schools in the neighborhoods in which they're looking to buy. A new report from the housing data firm RealtyTrack looks at school quality and home affordability in zip codes across the country. It found Phoenix buyers could find affordable homes in 22 zip codes with good schools, which were defined in this report as those with test scores one-third higher than the state average. For more on this, I'm joined by Darren Bloomquist, vice president of RealtyTrack. And Darren, Phoenix had the third highest number of these zip codes in the country. Does that mean home buyers can afford houses near good schools?
Yeah, and that's it's really true across the country, even though unfortunately it's the exception rather than the rule. But there are certainly areas where you have that sweet combination of affordable homes and really good schools. And in Phoenix, we saw out of 47 zip codes that have at least one good school, out of those, 22 of the 47 zip codes were also affordable. So you really see almost, not quite 50%, but about 46% of all zip codes with good schools there in Phoenix actually are still affordable. It wasn't quite so good nationwide, where only 35% of the zip codes with good schools were affordable.
What does that tell you about the Phoenix housing market?
Well, yeah, it tells us about the housing market, I think, more than anything else, that it is one of those markets that has managed to maintain its affordability, especially for first-time home buyers. Even through this recovery where we've seen home prices increase fairly dramatically, Phoenix is one of those markets that stayed relatively affordable across the board. And of course, then this applies even to markets that have good schools. Now, what we find is you're going to probably pay a little bit more in a market that has a good school for a home, but it's still, at least in Phoenix, it's still affordable in many of the areas.
Did you find that those houses and those zip codes are affordable because of the recession, that prices went down so far that maybe they, you know, in 2006 or 7, they may not have been affordable?
Yes, the recession in effect did help affordability. It made more homes more affordable, and we still haven't recovered all of the value in homes that we saw during the last housing bubble, which I think is actually a good thing. And in Phoenix, we've seen really the market behaving rationally rather than the market behaving badly during the last housing bubble. We've seen home prices slow down. They're still increasing, but they're over the last almost a year now, we've seen home prices increasing only in the low single-digit percentages year over year in terms of home prices, as opposed to 20 or 30% a year. And that's more sustainable and more reasonable going forward for affordability.
Do you think that this amount of affordability in zip codes with good schools is sustainable? Because as you pointed out, you know, home prices tend to be a little bit higher when there's a good school nearby. It's a good selling point for a lot of folks. So do you expect that the prices in some of these zip codes will start to rise?
Yes, you know, it's a catch-22. It's good to have those affordable homes in good school districts, but that will create more demand, which we expect would push prices up faster in those zip codes with the good schools going forward, which then could, unfortunately, at some point, make them less affordable for more people. So, you know, I don't know if there's any quick answer to that, but that's somewhat the nature of it. But, you know, still, I think the good news is that there are quite a few schools to pick from that are in affordable neighborhoods, although, you know, certainly it's less than 50%, so your choice is somewhat narrowed there in the Phoenix metro area.
Darren Bloomquist is vice president at RealtyTrack. Darren, thank you.
Thank you so much.
School funding in Arizona is much debated as the legislature works on the education budget and districts turn to overrides. While many overrides passed earlier this month, one rural school district's override failed for the fourth year in a row. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports, that could mean students will continue using outdated technology and school buses.
It's the end of the school day at Nottaburg Elementary School, and staff mingle while the children climb onto buses to go home. Some of these buses are over 10 years old. And Nottaburg Unified School District Superintendent Rick Steven says that concerns him.
This year we did cut back on a few of our routes that were on dirt roads that were very rough. You know, there's a lot of wear and tear to the axles. We're just concerned about the safety of it.
To replace the buses, Nottaburg tried to pass a $525,000 override earlier this year.
You know, I think I was surprised that it was voted no, but I think I was really surprised that it was a 2-to-1 margin of no.
Nottaburg is in Whitman in the northwestern part of Maricopa County. The district serves about 900 students in a rural community. Voters like John Godleski and his wife voted no on the override because they thought the funds would have been more money than the schools needed. And they're on a fixed income, Social Security.
It's not that we want to close a school down or anything. We don't. And we did read about the buses and everything else. They wanted to replace all the buses new, which we didn't feel was right.
Steven says the district would have replaced 2 buses per year if the override had passed. That funding would have also gone to upgrading the school's technology. That technology includes 15-year-old computers and iPads the school has on grants, which technology director Holly Taylor says are almost useless because there is no Wi-Fi in many of the classrooms.
We've tapped as many grants that we can, but a lot of grants are for components, but the pieces that we need to run the systems aren't there.
Not only is the technology outdated, it also becomes a difficulty in the age of online testing, like the AZ Merit Test, scores for which came out earlier this week. Taylor says it's frustrating when the technology fails and leaves the young student unmotivated.
That was the part that was the hardest, is a kid would be typing their little heart out, they read every piece, and then they'd hit submit and it would crash. And they'd lose everything, and to motivate a kid to go back and redo everything they've done.
Taylor says this young generation learning technology now is facing a future that includes technology as a huge part of their career.
There's a lot of shifts in technology. We're kind of going away from basic application to the makerspaces and the kids creating. They're saying by the time these kids graduate, there's 75% of the jobs will be new and things that we didn't even anticipate. So how are we preparing them for something so crazy like that?
Other district resident Mark Bailey doesn't think that's what the money will go to because of a tax mistake that overcharged district voters a few years ago.
It was an astronomical amount of taxes they were taking from us for this. I mean, if it was just a couple bucks, okay, go ahead and take it and put it in the bank to build up for your school, but we were getting an astronomical amount.
The thing is, I think people don't trust us, We do get a lot of support from our community, but I just feel like maybe there are some things that have happened in the past that they just haven't been able to get over.
Steven says so far with this year's expenditures, the capital funds the school gets from the state are already depleted from $200,000 to $20,000.
It's really putting us in some desperate times, and I understand people say what they say or believe what they believe, but the reality is we are going to be in some very desperate times over the next couple of years.
So if a bus breaks down or the servers fail, the district might have to take from the budget that goes to teacher salaries. Steven says he doesn't know if an override will be on the ballot next year. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's variety of hiking trails parallels the general kind of land the state has, from flat desert to desert mountain to high country hills. Some of these areas are pretty rugged, so what goes into creating the trails here and in other parts of the country? To get some context, we turn to Wesley Trimble of the American Hiking Society in Colorado. Wesley, what steps go into planning and actually creating a trail?
One of the biggest components to planning trails to begin with is typically what their usage is going to be. A lot of times, organizations try to plan trails around specific usage, whether that's a foot trail or if it's going to be equestrian or designed for mountain bikes specifically. So a lot of times, kind of the use of the trail will kind of dictate some of the planning and kind of the strategy for planning the trail. In that sense, whatever the primary usage will dictate the approach to how trails get designed.
And how long can it take?
It really depends on the terrain and more steep terrain, building trails gets a lot more complicated. And it really depends on how accessible it is. Obviously, more remote backcountry trails take a lot more time to accomplish because you have to get trail crew workers into those remote locations. So it takes a longer period of time to construct those trails versus trails that are more kind of what we would call like front country, like accessed from typical roads and kind of close to cities and whatnot.
Have you had experience in helping put together a trail, helping out with the team?
I've done a few years of trail crew. Basically, I've done 4 seasons of trail construction with a youth corps. So a lot of my trail experience is based in the youth corps world.
When you were involved as a youth or when you go out and hike, which I presume you do pretty frequently, to me, it's really intriguing, the idea of the way the trails are drawn. Is that still interesting and exciting to you to even think, or do you just kind of go ahead, you're just an experienced hiker and you don't think about stuff like that?
No, I absolutely do see, every time I hike a trail, I'll notice how it's designed or what type of structures they use to keep water off the trail. And so I definitely do have a keen eye for places where I think they could be improved or places where, you know, you can see a lot more erosion. So I'm always pick up on those features.
How delicate do you have to be based on? We're obviously talking about nature. You want to maintain the environment. So there's that balancing act too, right?
A lot of times before major trail projects get constructed or even approved, they have to go through an environmental assessment of the area in which the trail is going to get placed. And a lot of times those analysis will basically be created so that people can know what impact constructing the trail through specific areas will have.
Yeah, they always talk about, Wesley, you know, you got to stay on the trail. Are you someone who even as an experienced hiker, do you tend to look for more challenging trails? Because there are some people who, there is that temptation. You see, now, why is the trail like this? I'd really like to go to this other spot, but I guess I shouldn't just in case. For you as an experienced hiker, are you more motivated to go on the more challenging trails, or do you sort of have a whole variety for yourself?
It really just depends on kind of what I'm in the mood for. You know, I have done some very ambitious trails. I currently live in Colorado, so I've done the vast majority of the Colorado 14,000-foot peaks, which are pretty challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still county parks just around the area that I live that are much more tame, I guess you could say. And I still enjoy those. A lot of times when I take a lunch break, I like to go out on the easier trail. So it really just depends on what I'm trying to achieve.
Wesley Trimble of the American Hiking Society in Colorado.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Good. Good cut.
Hi, my name's Danae, and I'm here for a hitting lesson at Challenge Baseball and Softball Lessons.
Very good.
I'm trying to get ready for college. I want to be a starter as a freshman, so I'm just working hard and coming here to make sure my hitting's where I need to be to play at the collegiate level.
Keep that front arm across your chest, right? And the bottom hand stays with your back hip.
Right now, the thing I'm working on is not dropping my hands.
What about that, huh?
That was better.
Yeah, that was crush.
I think it's getting better. It's a long process, but it's slowly getting better.
Good. Ooh, that looked very smooth. Yes.
I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I know I can do better, and I always want to be perfect, but of course you can't. But we're getting better at that.
That's Danae Chapman honing her softball skills at the Challenge Indoor Training Facility. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or wonder why we keep whiffing, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, researchers want to make it easier to understand your medical care.
Right now, there are a lot of texts out there that are too difficult to understand. And so we want to provide a tool that helps the providers of the text of the information to simplify that information.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. Watch out for a collision on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Southern. It's blocking the shoulder. As far as weather goes, we'll stay sunny throughout the rest of this afternoon. Looking for a high temperature of 76. We should warm to 79 under clear skies tomorrow. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. Sunny and 73 degrees at KJZZ at 2:33.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Gamage Beyond, presenting Moon Medicine, a musical and optical experiment weaving images, dance, and video, conducted by interdisciplinary artist Sanford Biggers, November 21st at 7 p.m. at ASU Gamage.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In the news from KJZZ, the number of Mexican immigrants in the U.S. that have moved back to Mexico now outpaces those making the journey here. That's according to new data released by the Pew Research Center. KJZZ's Carrie Young reports.
Mexican demographic data show between 2009 and 2014, more than 1 million Mexicans moved back to Mexico from the United States. However, U.S. Census information reveals roughly 870,000 Mexican nationals made the move here in the same time period. The exact reason for the decline is not entirely clear. Some economists say it could be the result of a slow economic recovery in the U.S. since the Great Recession. Stricter enforcement of immigration law is also a factor. According to Mexican population data, most of the 1 million people that moved back to Mexico did so on their own, and mostly for family reunification. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Of the various ways of getting into the United States, applying for political refugee status or seeking some humanitarian asylum is hardly the easiest. Since 2012, there have been only 1,854 Syrian refugees admitted to the U.S.
President Obama has said we'll take an additional 10,000 in fiscal year 2016, likely now with tough new vetting and background checks if the resettlement program happens at all.
But consider 20 million people who traveled to the U.S. in fiscal year 2013 under the barely scrutinized Visa Waiver Program, a program that allows citizens of 38 approved countries, Western allies, and Japan to travel here for tourism or business for up to 90 days without having to obtain a visa. The Belgian and French citizens who were the Paris attackers, in theory, might have been eligible for visa waivers, but Congress seems not to be concerned about that program right now. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says it's refugees and not free-to-roam European citizens under the visa waiver program who are being deemed a threat by a Congress in crisis mode where reality can be swept aside.
The Paris attacks stoked anger and sadness, but also fear and speculation. It induced calls to seal the border. More than two dozen Republican governors raced each other to announce that they would harbor no refugees from Syria. GOP presidential candidates demanded the program be stopped. Some even demanded that only Christians be admitted as refugees. There was just too high a risk, they said, that terrorists could be among them. Here's Republican Congressman Dave Bratt describing his Virginia constituents.
I mean, just overwhelming outcry from my district. I've heard the same. They want action. The folks want action right now.
And action right now is what they've got. On the House floor today, a bill essentially halting the Syria refugee program. A Bloomberg poll shows that 53% of Americans support halting the program. And that prompted protests from Democrats, including the president, that refugees were being painted with a broad brush, that they're already undergoing background checks that take up to 2 years, and that closing the door to war refugees was just un-American. Congressman Mike McCall of Texas chairs the Homeland Security Committee. He stressed to reporters that speed is critical this week, that Americans want to see Congress take action, and that House Republicans want to deliver that action before leaving town for Thanksgiving. But McCall also said that security officials, including FBI Director James Comey, have warned that the security of the refugee program is inadequate.
Fact of the matter is, the threat's real. And ISIS has said in their own words they want to exploit it to infiltrate the West. So, it's not a threat I'm making up. It's a threat that the administration's own officials have warned us about.
There is suspicion that at least one of the ISIS terrorists in Paris entered Europe posing as a refugee. But even before McCall announced his bill earlier this week, lawmakers of both parties were already grumbling that they didn't really see the refugee program as a big risk. Senator Richard Burr is GOP chairman of the Intelligence Committee. He supports pausing the Syrian refugee program, but I asked him how refugees ranked as a national security threat.
from a threat standpoint, I'm probably more concerned with the visa waiver program today, because were I in Europe already and I wanted to go to the United States and I was not on a watch list or a no-fly list and I wanted to get there, the likelihood is I'd use the visa waiver program before I would try to pawn myself off as a refugee and try to enter under false documents.
38 countries qualify for the visa waiver program. Travelers from places like Germany, the UK, Australia, and France don't need a visa to enter and stay in the U.S. for 90 days. Over 13 million travelers got visa waivers in 2014. Compared to the 10,000 proposed under the refugee program, visa waiver is a flood. Ease of travel is vital to business and tourism, commerce worth billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. Nathan Sale is a law professor at Syracuse University, and he's written about reforms to visa waivers.
So I think the visa waiver program is an important tool, not only for economic reasons, but also for national security reasons. But it's also really important to close any loopholes the terrorists might use to exploit and attack us here at home.
Republicans like Mike McCall say they're also in favor of tightening the visa waiver program. There's momentum building for possible reforms in early December. But the program is complex. It has lots and lots of powerful stakeholders with a lot to lose. Halting the refugee program, on the other hand, is popular, and it's a way to show angry and scared voters results now. But it's also how the refugee program is stopped that tells you a lot. McCall's bill is actually really simple. It requires the head of the FBI and other top security chiefs to ramp up security vetting for refugees headed for the U.S., but it doesn't tell agencies how to increase security or give them more money to do it. It really only does one important thing. It says that the chiefs have to personally certify that each and every refugee cleared for entry isn't a threat. Here's Mike McCall.
That's why it's important that we have all three, one representing the intelligence community, one federal law enforcement, FBI, and the other, the Secretary of Homeland Security, signing off, assuring the Congress and the American people that they do not pose a threat to the United States.
Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is one of the people who'd have to personally certify each and every refugee. When I caught up with him on Capitol Hill, he said that 10,000 refugees would mean he would have to sign off on 30 persons a day.
To personally certify with respect to 30 people a day that certain requirements have been met is hugely cumbersome, and I don't think the American people will think that that is the best and wisest use for the Secretary of Homeland Security to be spending his time.
But Mike McCall is very clear about what he wants out of this bill, and it's not to waste Jay Johnson's time. It's to give him and the FBI director and the director of national intelligence direct political responsibility for the refugees and clear culpability if anything goes wrong.
Because they will own it. And if they make a mistake, it's their mistake.
This is what legislating under the fear of terrorism and the glare of a presidential primary election looks like. John, there's an old cliche in politics about throwing people under the bus, and we all know what it means. This bill seems to be alerting top Obama administration officials that when it comes to domestic terror, Congress has a bus idling and it might soon get rolling, and that they may wish to take steps to avoid getting under it.
So, Todd, I'm wondering if the visibility of this program or lack of visibility of this program is going to keep it from becoming a big political issue.
No, John, as we sort of mentioned earlier, lawmakers of both parties say they want to pass some reforms to visa waivers, but they're not going to get to it now. They'll probably get to it later on this winter. What they're going to get to right now is a demand from scared and angry voters, and they're pretty clear about it.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You got it.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The English language is full of words and terms that, whether they started that way or not, are seen as pejorative. When we hear them, we get a little uncomfortable and even wonder why they're still part of the vernacular. For a number of members of Congress, the word alien, as applied to immigrants, falls into that category. Arizona's 7th District Congressman Ruben Gallego is supporting the Correcting Hurtful and Alienating Names in Government Expression, or CHANGE Act. It would eliminate alien from federal law and government signs and literature.
You know, our immigration is policies are no longer black and white as they were in the past. We have people in this country that are legally here, under permission that are here with some types of visas, but we still will give them a title of a alien national with permission or some other type of wording with the word alien in versus something that is more legalistic and it's more modern, which we use of terms as such as foreign nationals without permission, things of that nature, which I think are more reflective, one, of the values of where our society has gone, but two, legally speaking, is more accurate also.
Is this something that constituents came to you with? Is this something you've ever experienced?
This was brought to me actually by another member of Congress, but we have seen different people in my congressional office, kind of bring up the subject matter that, no, they're not aliens. They always try to joke about it, but like, I'm not an alien, I'm a human being, and or other people just being, offended that they're being called aliens, though they're also in the country with status. And, it's a word that the government uses that's outdated. If, the civilian world would like to use it in whatever manner, I mean, that is their prerogative, but we as a country, when we are dealing with our citizenry and dealing with each other, should use the most modern, language possible.
In the big picture of immigration reform, does it help even a skosh to have terms like this out of the vernacular, at least certainly out of official documents, in erasing some maybe certain biases people might have already built into that word? If that word's out of it, does that help the conversation
right. Start
at a different place?
Well, certainly it could, because I think it would encourage people to actually look deeper into immigration issues and not just a black and white issue, because that's just not the case. You have people in this country that are different levels of transition through immigration. Some people that are here without permission. There are some people that came here with permission but are no longer in compliance but are trying to get back into compliance. And if I think Americans could actually kind of understand a little deeper how immigration works in this country, I think we would be able to find more solutions to what I think we all agree is a immigration problem.
And then, Congressman, finally, when it comes to logistics, where are we in terms of where the legislation is at, and do you think it has legs?
I don't believe it has legs this year, and mostly just to kind of get the ball rolling. And you have to still go through the process, really talking to other members of Congress and explain to them why this is not a radical change. This doesn't confer any kind of immigration status on anybody. We're not going to, by changing the terminology, we're not going to make anybody a citizen or anything of that nature.
Congressman Ruben Gallego, he represents Arizona's 7th District. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
To learn more about why the term alien moved into common usage, we're joined by University of California, Berkeley sociologist Edwin Ackerman. Edwin, as far as the timeline, people started hearing the word in the context of immigration in the 1970s?
One thing that starts happening during the 60s is that partly as a result of the sort of victory, to some degree, of the civil rights movement, overt racism wasn't permissible anymore in the public sphere. And there's a big group of people, big group of organizations that push back against particularly racialized notions used at the time. A particularly prevalent term in that period was wetback. So against terms like those, groups start to push for a sort of more neutral or deracialized language. And illegal, which was, again, already sort of floating there, starts to get more traction.
This was a term that was put into effect as a pejorative, as a derogatory term. You mentioned racism. So this was definitely definitely meant to belittle the folks who were coming from other countries.
I think initially the idea is actually to sort of fight racism with something like this. The idea is that as opposed to some sort of terminology that points to race or that had been associated with race, this has an air of neutrality. This is in the first sort of this is in the period of the 70s. So that at that point it's not actually used as code for this particular sort of immigrant groups that the country doesn't want. It has a neutral air to it. That's partly why later in the 90s, the right wing is able to pick it up and use it as code. They don't have to say Mexicans, essentially. They can say illegal aliens, and everybody knows exactly who they're talking about. So the term ends up serving as a code for this particular group, right? But the reason why it's able to be used as a code is because it initially had an air of neutrality to it.
Now, from my conversation with Representative Gallego, the representative even said to me that some people come to his office and they say, I want you to get rid of this. And then they'll laugh a little bit because they feel like, well, I have to tell people I'm not a Martian because that's what I think of when I think of alien.
Right, right. I think that it definitely has power. So these words, I mean, on the one hand, they're really indicators of the way we think about these problems, but at the same time, they reproduce a certain way of thinking about those problems. That's why focusing on terminology can be important from the point of view of, say, political activism. If we start changing the way we think about these problems, eventually you'll see a change in the terminology as well. But it can also work in the other direction. Yeah, of course, the term alien has this sense of a sort of radical otherness.
UC Berkeley sociologist Edwin Ackerman. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. Quickly in Valley traffic, there's an accident I-10 westbound at 7th Street. It's blocking the shoulder. We should stay sunny for the rest of this afternoon, and we may reach the forecast high of 76. Then for tonight, clear skies, lows around 50, sunny and warmer tomorrow with highs in the upper 70s. Currently, relative humidity at 23%, clear skies and 73 degrees at 2:52.
KJZZ is supported by Crooked Sky Farms, now harvesting their fall heirloom field tomato crop at farmers markets and 14 weekly community-supported agriculture pickup locations around the valley. Details at crookedskyfarms.com.
Arizona's grocery market is going through a kind of deja vu. Albertsons will buy three of Hagen's Arizona grocery stores just months after Hagen bought them from Albertsons. The Federal Trade Commission forced that sale over concerns about competition after Albertsons and Safeway merged. Hagen announced earlier it would close all 10 of its stores here. For more on this, we turn to David Livingston, a supermarket research consultant with DLJ Research.
I think those are stores that Albertsons would have liked to have kept, but the FTC required them to sell off.
Is this not a competitive problem now, whereas it was a couple months ago?
I don't see it being much of a problem. You know, Albertsons, this is a good deal for them because they were able to sell these stores and get a certain price for them, and they can probably buy them back a little bit cheaper now. So it's Albertsons is a money head. It'll take a while to build the business back up. You know, Hagen's, pretty much destroyed their business in these stores. So it'll take Albertsons a while to bring it back. But I think long term, this is a good deal for the Albertsons Safeway group.
Do you think that Albertsons should have been made to get rid of these stores in the first place?
No, that was just a silly thing. These markets are extremely competitive. If you're in Phoenix, you've got Winco and Walmart and Costco. You've got a number of price operators down there. It wouldn't have hurt the consumer one bit for Albertsons and Safeway to keep these stores.
So how does Albertsons and Safeway go about sort of rebuilding their brand and getting customers back in the stores now?
Well, they've got a lot of work to do. I think, they'll just do some promoting and they've got name brand recognition in the market. You know, people know their name. They haven't been out of the market that long. Some of these locations are pretty good. And some of these are actually doing quite well for them historically. So I don't think it'll take long for them to come back. They probably won't come back as well as they were doing before because the customers have gone somewhere else now. But long term, I think it'll be a good deal for Albertsons Safeway.
Is this the kind of thing where they're going to have to run some, crazy specials or sales to get people in the door?
I don't think they'll do that. I don't think they'll go too crazy. They might for a little bit, but for the most part, I think they'd like to slowly ease back into the market and continue to operate as though nothing had happened.
David Livingston is a supermarket research consultant with DLJ Research. We were talking about Albertsons buying back three grocery stores in Arizona from Hagen months after selling them to the Washington state-based company.
There's a lot of medical information available out there, but a lot of it is written, well, medically. The University of Arizona has been awarded a grant to simplify health information. The nearly $1.5 million will help develop the free online tool. Gandhi Leroy is leading the research. She's an associate professor in the Department of Management Information Systems at the U of A.
We are working on a tool that is going to be used by healthcare providers to bring texts, to rewrite texts that they already have or that they want to write and make it simpler so that we can increase the comprehension of people reading it. So right now there are a lot of texts out there that are too difficult to understand. And so we want to provide a tool that helps the providers of the texts of the information to simplify that information.
So are you talking about like medical journals, things like that?
Well, it depends on the information they want to provide. Currently, many hospitals provide information online, and sometimes they provide research information from research studies, but quite often it's more general information. So we're looking to help them simplify the information they already provide online. Hopefully, it will be useful for people who want to send, for example, emails with information to simplify that information, or if they want to rephrase some of the research studies. So any type of medical information that the providers want to provide, we want to help them write it in such a way that it's easier to understand.
Why do you think it is so challenging right now for doctors to communicate with their patients and with other people who are just interested in this information in a way that's easy for people who, you know, didn't go to med school to understand?
Well, there are a lot of factors, right? So there is a huge increase in people with chronic diseases, and the treatments for these are becoming more complex. People quite often have to take a more active role in their healthcare. Many people also want to be educated. You know, patient empowerment is important to help make good decisions when you're part of a medical team to take care of your own health. And so doctors don't always have the time. The diseases are complex. The treatments are complex. People want to be educated. And so that's why they can really use some help in bringing that information in a better way.
Is there something to be said, though, just for doctors being able to do that on their own to patients, to communicate with them in a way that their patients can understand?
Well, ideally, of course, but you don't always know how much a patient already knows or what their reading skills are. And this also goes further than just doctor-patient communication.
So how are you going to go about building this?
Well, it's not something you do in 2 months. So this is a project that will take a few years. And we have started a while ago. And so what we do is we try to find features in the text, so elements of text that are indicative of difficult or easy text. And once we can find them, we try to develop algorithms that will translate something that is difficult into an easier version. And so there's a lot of computer science involved in detecting these difficult sections and translating them into easier versions. But we also do a lot of studies to verify that it really is easier. So we want to make sure if we're going to simplify text that it will actually help people understand. So we test this by giving people a text and asking questions about the content. And then we hope that with our simplifications, they will be able to answer the questions with higher accuracy. So once we discover a lot of features like this that can help simplify text, we will then combine that into one tool. And you can think of it as something like a word editor where we will indicate, well, this is a difficult section. Here are some suggestions on how you can simplify it. And then the person writing the text can make the final decision in simplifying that text based on our suggestions.
So do you envision then that the writers of these texts would sort of put their article or put their entry into this program and the program would say, okay, this is fine, this needs a little work, this is really confusing, this part is fine here?
Yep, exactly.
I would imagine that you have to be fairly precise when you're coming up with the alternative ways to say certain things, because a wrong word when it comes to something medical could be a really big problem for somebody, right?
Yes, and especially so in medicine. So that's why we do not automate this translation process. There will always be a human in the loop. So we will provide suggestions, but the person writing the article will make the final decision on how the text will be simplified.
Gandhi Leroy is an associate professor in the Department of Management Information Systems at the U of A and is working on developing the tool to simplify medical texts. Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Coming up, the Ducey administration is changing the process used for vetting judges, and we'll take a look at the Arizona wine industry. Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And if you've got some free time tonight, Mark, you can't do this because you're allergic, but the Crescent Ballroom tonight at 7, Jackson Galaxy and Kate Benjamin will have their book signing, Catify to Satisfy.
Ooh, that would not be good for me. No. There'd be a lot of sneezing there. Yeah, a lot of sneezing. The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
All Things Considered is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where cancer specialists work together to provide personalized care right here in Metro Phoenix. More at mayoclinic.org/cancer.